So this is the second in what will probably be a three-part series called How to Quit Complaining. In the first part we discussed last week, there are four kinds of complainers. It's a habit that we want to break because anyone who complains is miserable, otherwise they wouldn't be complaining in the first place. And because they're complaining, they're a killjoy. They're making everyone around them unhappy. So it's a hard habit to break because our whole society is negative, and negativity is kind of built into us. Negativity surrounds us. Negativity, bad news sells newspapers. Bad news is what's headlined on the CNN newscast every night. And it's not surprising that we tend to go on the negative side. In fact, we quipped the first time that we're so negative in the modern age that a lot of us even have negative blood types. Now, there are four types of negative people, and each one of them has a telltale phrase. And we went over these last week. We'll just quickly review them. So if you hear one of these and it's something that you say often, then that would identify you as one of these four types of negative people. The first one is a whiner. Some people rise and shine, but most people rise and whine. And the rise and whiner, their telltale phrase is that life is not fair. Life is just not fair. Then the next type of negative person is the martyr. And the martyr says, nobody appreciates me. They're good at having pity parties, going around and murmuring, starting their little protest campaigns on the periphery and quiet, and going behind the head of the family's back or the boss's back. Mary Martyr. Nobody appreciates me. And then the third type of a whiner is the cynic. And the cynic says, nothing ever changes. Everything's always the same. No matter what we do, it's always the same old, same old. There's really nothing you can do to improve things or to make things better. We're just up against it. And then the fourth type of complainer is the perfectionist. And the perfectionist, instead of building people up, maybe a boss, it may be a parent to the child, instead of affirming a person's worth, they're always detracting. They're always taking away from the person's worth. And the famous, the most often quoted telltale phrase of the perfectionist is that the best you can do? Is that the best you can do? I told the story a few weeks ago about Bruce Wilkerson. He was a rookie professor at a small New England college, and he got his course assignments. They were passed out from the dean's office. And one of his co-teachers looked over his shoulder, and out of the five sections he had of students, the co-teacher said, Bruce, you lucky dog. Bruce said, what is that? He said, out of those five sections, two of them are the grade A students. It's a class, section A. You have two section A's out of your five teaching sections. So Bruce thought, well, that must be pretty good. And so throughout the semester, he saw the students in those two classes as section A students. He saw them as exceptional students, and he treated them accordingly, and he had higher expectations of them, and he was more affirmative towards them, and he had a subtle negative feeling towards the other three. And then, sure enough, at the end of the semester, the students in the two Section A classes wrote longer term papers, which is always a good sign of enthusiasm. They got better grades than the students in the other three sections. So the next year, Bruce came back, and the dean was passing out the course assignments. And Bruce said, I hope I get some Section A students this year. I hope I get some Section A classes. And the dean said, Bruce, what are you talking about? Section A classes. I had two Section A classes, and they were a dream to teach, and they performed accordingly. The dean said, we don't have Section A classes. Sure you do. I had two of them last semester, and they outperformed the other three. He said, Bruce, we discontinued. We had it about 6 years ago, but we discontinued the program about 6 years ago. Those were not Section A classes. Those were just ordinary students, just like the other three. But because you dealt with them, because you thought of them more affirmatively, they responded to you, and they fulfilled your expectations. So if you're the perfectionist, all you do is run people down. Is that the best you can do? Is that the best you can do? You complain about them instead of complimenting them. Now, Krishna does not want us to complain. He does not want us to be negative. It's just like if you have a party and there are all kinds of friends and intimate acquaintances, but there's one person in the party that's negative. They don't like the snacks. They don't like the dip. They don't like the drinks. They don't like you. They don't like your house. They don't like the music. So who wants them? Who needs them? So Krishna is basically telling us that if we want to enter into the spiritual world, we need to get over this habit of complaining, because there's no room for negativity in the spiritual world. Now, do you think Gandhari was a negative person? I mean, compared to people today, Gandhari was like a super duper positive person. She never complained. I mean, she was tough compared to today's standards. She was so tough that when she heard that she was betrothed to a blind king, Dhritarashtra, rather than take the chance of her being a condescending wife or thinking of herself as being superior to her husband, she voluntarily blinded herself by tying her eyes with linen. And she lived her whole life sightless to put herself on an equal level with her husband. Now, I don't think this is the kind of a lady that you'd call a cynic or a whiner or even a perfectionist or a martyr. This is a lady that underwent all this voluntarily in order to live a happy, amicable life with her husband. Not a lady that's going to complain at the drop of a hat. And yet, when her 100 sons were killed, she leveled a complaint against Krishna, and she even cursed him. These are the words that Gandhari said. And who can blame? I mean, who can blame? You've had, 100 sons killed. Krishna was personally present on the battlefield. And so, naturally, you want to lash out and you want to blame someone. So here's the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And she says these words in the Mahabharata to Krishna. And you can see her pointing at him, ready to curse him. She says, "The Pandavas and Kauravas have been rooted out, O Krishna, even before your eyes." In other words, she's saying the whole military might of the world is now dead. So what will become of the world when we don't have our protectors, you see? When the house doesn't have any security systems, doesn't have any watchdogs, and a society of thieves, it's only a matter of time before the occupants are destroyed. So she says, "Why were you indifferent to them? Krishna himself appeared as a kshatriya, paritranaya sadhanam. I come to protect the pious and to annihilate the miscreants." So how is that going to be accomplished in the absence of an entire kshatriya class? So isn't this a contradiction, Gandhari saying? You personally validate the kshatriya race by incarnating as a kshatriya, and then in your presence the whole kshatriya race is eliminated. So what's going on here? "You could have prevented the slaughter, O Madhava." Now, Madhava means the husband of the goddess of fortune. So how can there be fortune when all the warriors, all the protectors are dead? There's an irony here. If you are the goddess of fortune, then how come that you have allowed to destroy all the protectors of our fortune? "Since you deliberately allowed this universal destruction," and here's our curse, "you should now feel the consequences. The ladies of your family will thus weep, even as the Kuru ladies are doing." And this is the curse whereby the Yadu dynasty was later to gather at Prabhas, and with the bulrushes that were made of iron, in the course of reenacting the Kurukshetra war, lay each other low and in effect eliminate the whole Yadu dynasty from the face of the earth, and then all their queens would have cried just in the way that the wives of Gandhari's sons would cry also. Now Krishna answers Gandhari in such a way as to send her a signal that even though you are a upright, stand-up lady, even though you are not given to complaining, and even though there is significant cause for complaint, I mean, a mother has just lost every one of her 100 sons, not a single one was spared. So there was certainly provocation, but Krishna says, in spite of the provocation, and in spite of your character, I do not tolerate complaints. I do not tolerate negative attitudes. And he brings her right up short. He brings her right up short. This is Krishna's retort to Gandhari's accusations. "Arise, O Gandhari, and shake off your grief. Your son Duryodhana, whom neither you nor your husband stopped," putting it back on her. This is part of a category for overcoming complaining, for quitting complaining. Last week we talked about acknowledging or admitting that complaining is a problem for us is one step in overcoming this habit. And the second step is in taking responsibility for our own lives. We're always blaming and pointing the finger at other people If it wasn't for my wife, I would be this way. If it wasn't for my former wife, I would be this way. If it wasn't for my kids, I would be this way. If it wasn't for my boss, I would be this way. We're always trying to shift the blame. There are accusers, excusers, and choosers. And accusers always point the finger at someone else. Oh, he's the cause, she's the cause, he's the cause. And excusers always say, it's not my fault, it's the environment, it's the society, it's the times that we live in, it's the economy. And choosers accept responsibility for their actions. Choosers acknowledge that whatever is coming upon me at the present moment, whether it be good or ill, is as a result of my actions. Karma means as you sow, so you shall reap. What goes around comes around. So Krishna puts it right back on Gandhari where it belongs. And why is it her fault? He says, shake off your son Duryodhana, whom neither you nor your husband stopped, was malicious, envious, and arrogant. Why do you blame others for your own fault? There was a young man, Prabhupada told this story one time, of a young man who had committed murder. He'd been raised by his aunt and spoiled by his aunt. She never disciplined him. And eventually he got so whimsical and wayward that he committed murder. And he was in jail. He was going to be hanged on the following day. So his aunt came to visit him. And she said, is there anything I can do for you on this last day of your life? He said, yeah, lean a little closer. Bend over. Put your ear between the bars. I have something to tell you. So she put her ear between the bars. And he viciously bit her, causing blood to flow. And she said, is this the thanks I get for raising you all these years? And he said, Auntie, if you had not spoiled me, I would not be here today. If you had disciplined me, if you had exercised loving discipline, I would not be here facing the gallows now. So Krishna is saying the same thing to Gandhari. If you had disciplined your son, this whole war would not have taken place. So don't blame me. Don't blame me. Ultimately, our fate is created by none other than ourselves. From the beginning, you should not have allowed your son to live. He was the embodiment of hostility and disobedient to his elders. Duryodhana was the ultimate complainer. He never saw anything good in anyone. Talk about running people down. Talk about saying, is this the best you can do? Duryodhana personified the perfectionist. He never even saw good in the Pandavas. Pandavas were spotless. And yet Duryodhana imagined faults in the Pandavas. And because of his negative attitude, he brought about an entirely negative result in the form of the Kurukshetra War. Thus he has met a fitting end. Give up your useless grief, for by indulging it, it simply increases. It's another thing. The more we blame other people, the more we accuse, the more we excuse, the more that the grief increases. As a Brahmin woman brings forth children to practice austerity and a Vaishya bears offspring for keeping cows, so a Kshatriya warrior woman brings forth sons to be killed in battle. There's a saying that Chanaka coined 3 centuries before Christ. He said, just as a priest loves feasts, in India the Brahmins, they have these nice little bellies. They love to go to feasts. Whenever you have a wedding or housewarming, you invite all the Brahmins and feed them sumptuously with nice ghee-produced items, and they have these little ghee bellies, you know. So as Brahmins love feasts, as cows love fresh grasses, as calves love the milk of their cows, you know, the little calves, they love to get the milk from the udders of the calves. So as Brahmins love feasts, as cows love fresh green grasses, the lamas are the same. They don't like tall grasses. There's no juice in the tall grasses. They get the shorter grass. And for wheat grass also, there's a point about 3 inches where there's a joint that occurs. And you want to get it before the joint happens, and then it's nice and juicy. So as Brahmins love feasts, as cows love fresh green grasses, as calves love milk, so warriors, they love war. They love war. So Duryodhana was a warrior. His 100 brothers were a warrior. The war could have been avoided any number of times. Krishna himself appealed for peace. The Pandavas asked only for 5 villages. It was Duryodhana and his 100 brothers who precipitated the war, who insisted on the war, who would not allow any other options in the war. And as warriors, they love war. So it must have been because they loved war that they refused the peaceful options, and so ultimately no one is to blame but them. Excusers here, this is a statement. The symptoms of the need for unconditional love are self-pity, depression, insecurity, isolation, and fear. Isn't that a pretty good thumbnail of modern society? Aren't people nowadays full of self-pity? Aren't they depressed? Depression is the number one health problem in the world. Aren't they insecure? Aren't they isolated in front of their Facebook screen and in their cars and in their houses? And aren't they also full of fear? Now, they have family members, they have a powerful nation that they live in. Most of them are gainfully employed. So why, in spite of all those obvious material advantages, do most people feel self-pity, depression, insecurity, isolation, and fear? Because they have not made their connection to God. Their connections are to all temporary things. Work, approval of parents and people on the job, financial security, health. Never before have people experienced these things to a degree that we're experiencing in America, and yet never before have people been so lacking in self-esteem and so depressed because they have failed to make their connection with God. In our modern secular society, there's not a God-centered, there's not a center of God. Now, when you become God conscious, and this is why we chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. One associates with the Lord through His holy name. And through the chanting and through the association with the Lord, one comes to feel never alone. One comes to realize that one is a son of the most exalted personality. Feels like one is protected, one feels like one has a companion in all circumstances, and the God-sized hole in our heart is filled, as it should be, with God. You can't fill a God-sized hole with temporary things. Not that these things aren't important, finances and health, but they're not meant to position themselves in the center of our hearts. So when the sense of God consciousness is there, then those same feelings of inadequacy become transformed into feelings of self-worth, joy, security, belonging, hope, and courage. Now, the difference between the former and the latter is just adding that element of chanting the holy names of the Lord and placing Krishna as the centerpiece in our hearts. So here also Yudhisthira, again in the Mahabharata, he becomes apprehensive, he becomes a little negative, and he turns to Arjuna. He sees all the Kauravas on the other side and he begins to have some negative feelings and he begins to sort of complain. Quote, "It seems to me that Bhishma has arranged his troops in an impenetrable formation. Our opponents have limitless strength." End quote. Yudhisthira appeared disconsolate and dejected. Now in answer to this, Arjuna was really positive. Arjuna offered words of encouragement. "Listen, O king, as I tell you how only a few men can overpower a vast army. Those who desire victory do not conquer by prowess, but by truth, compassion, piety, and virtue. Fight with assurance, dear brother, for victory is always where righteousness is found." Practically the last words in the Bhagavad Gita. Although the Pandavas were outnumbered by a ratio of 5-3, although the Pandavas had Bhishma, Dronacharya, Ashwatthama, they had about 7 Maharatas on their side, and the Kauravas basically only had Arjuna and Bhima. Although they were numerically outmanned, they had Krishna on their side. And Sanjaya, after describing the two armies, and in spite of this numerical superiority of the Kauravas, Sanjaya, at the end, tells Dhritarashtra, "Yatra Yogeshwara Krishna Yata Partha Dunur Dara Yata Sriya Vijaya Dhruvir Dhruva Nitir Matamama." He says, wherever there's Krishna, the master of mystic powers, Yogeshwara, Yata Partha Dunur Dara, and wherever there's Partha with his Gandhiva bow, there is victory, opulence, morality. He says, that is my opinion. So the way to victory is to align yourself with the righteous cause. That's the way to victory. And Arjuna is reassuring Yudhisthira. Yudhisthira is kind of an introspective, contemplative, self-doubting bit of a temperament. And so Arjuna is reinforcing him here, sort of bolstering up and saying, you know, our cause is right. And so don't worry about us having gotten ourselves into a situation we can't get out of. Still, Yudhisthira is not consoled. He's wondering whether the cause is even righteous, because he stands to gain from all this. He stands to replace Duryodhana as king. And so he's asking himself, he's agonizing over the question, are all these soldiers going to die, and all their wives going to be widows, and all their children become orphans, just for my ambition? Is that what this is all about? Is this carnage and slaughter going to take place just so that I can become king? And if that's so, how am I any better than Duryodhana? It seemed to him that his desire for the kingdom was at the root of this war. Now, Yudhisthira didn't really want the kingdom. It was Krishna who wanted the kingdom for Yudhisthira. But he's kind of going through it right now. Arjuna sensing his misgivings, continued, quote, "We have Krishna on our side. He is righteousness and truth personified. Victory is certain to go to Krishna and whoever is on his side. His might is infinite. He is the original person beyond and above this mundane world with all its politics and suffering. I do not see the cause for your sorrow when that Lord of the Celestials is on your side and wishing you success." Yudhisthira is asking, is all this happening so that I can become king? And Arjuna says, no. It's not happening to make you king. It's happening because Krishna is present. Krishna represents righteousness, an unlimited amount. And it's happening because Krishna wants it to. And it's going to happen in spite of you. So then, becoming more positive as a result of Arjuna's words, Yudhisthira felt pacified. He looks at his troops and he says, "It is exactly as you say, Arjuna. Krishna desires this conflict, and thus we should not hesitate. Tell our men to fight to the best of their power with fairness and with the desire to attain heaven." So this was Yudhisthira's Bhagavad Gita. This was Yudhisthira's Bhagavad Gita. First, Arjuna was negative. First, Arjuna was complaining, "Well, Krishna, fight, blah, 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 blah." And then Krishna spoke the whole Bhagavad Gita, at the end of which Arjuna said, "Nashta moha, shmitir labda, tat pashara mayachuta, shtito shmin gata sandeha, karishe vachanam tara." After hearing the positive words of Krishna, then Arjuna gave up his negativity. He stopped complaining. He said, "Now my illusion is finished, and I am prepared to fight according to your instructions." So then Arjuna takes this to Yudhisthira, who is also negative and complaining, and he gives Yudhisthira his little Bhagavad Gita as well. And in this way, Yudhisthira becomes bolstered up, and then he's ready to fight also. So there are accusers, there are excusers, and there are choosers. This is from the Srimad Bhagavatam regarding choosers. "To save a surrendered soul from repeated birth and death, the Lord purifies him of contamination by offering him a little distress. This cannot be understood by a non-devotee, but a devotee can see this because he is vipravit, or learned. A non-devotee, therefore, is perturbed in distress, but a devotee welcomes distress as another feature of the Lord. It is said that if a jeweler wants to make one gem shine greater than all the rest, he does more cutting on it." So when reverses come to those who are in a devotional mentality, they don't shake their fists at the heavens and say, "God, you know, why did you do this to me?" They say, "What is it that I have to learn from this? What lesson are you trying to teach me, Lord?" They choose to take responsibility for their own actions. And they blame none other than themselves for the pleasures and pains that have come this way. Because as soon as you recognize that you yourself are the architect of your own destiny, that your actions of the past have resulted in the reactions of the present, as soon as you realize that and shoulder that responsibility, then you can immediately act in the present in such a way as to eliminate all suffering in the future. And the ultimate choice that we make is to do everything on behalf of the Lord. To do everything on behalf of the Lord. Take the example of a drunk driver who's driving down the road and he runs over a little girl. That man is prosecutable. That man will go to prison for negligible homicide because he was acting on his own. Now, a fireman is driving a fire truck. He's working for the government. He's doing his job, going to the fire, trying to save lives. Little girl darts out in front. Tragically, she's run over. Nevertheless, that fireman is not held to the same level of accountability as the former case, because he's working on behalf of the government. He's doing his duty. So ultimately, if we want to make the best decision, if we want to make the best choice, we won't do anything independently. But before we engage in any course of action, we'll read the Bhagavad Gita, we'll chant Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, and we'll consult with other advanced, learned devotees of the Lord to verify that this is in fact something that will please the Lord, that will glorify the Lord. If in fact this is one of the purposes for which I was put here, and if the execution of this course of action will be in line with the talents and abilities that I have. So this is all part of accepting responsibility for our own actions and our own life. That was preceded by a point that we should admit that complaining is a problem for each and every one of us. And then we'll finish this with two more points, the first of which is to do everything with an attitude of gratitude, and then to see God's hand in everything. With those points, admitting that complaining or negativity is a problem for me, not just for others, taking responsibility for our own lives, and seeing God's hand in everything, and doing everything with an attitude of gratitude, then one will succeed in conquering this great negative habit of complaining. And as long as we're negative, as long as we're big complainers, Krishna just doesn't want us in the spiritual world spoiling the party. So we'll end that. That's section 2, and we'll finish next week with the last in a 3-part series called How to Quit Complaining.